Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the August 25th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. By now, if you're a regular listener to Democracy Now! And even NPR, you're familiar with the name of WikiLeaks and of its founder, Julian Assange, who last month turned over to the New York Times, the Guardian of London, and Germany's Der Spiegel nearly 80,000 classified U.S. government documents coming from the battlefield pertaining to the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's an awful lot of documents to sift through, so most of the attention has been paid to the U.S. pursuit of Assange and to the U.S. Army soldier Bradley Manning, who furnished WikiLeaks with the documents and who now sits in a military prison awaiting trial and a very long, perhaps lifetime, prison term. What information from the documents we have heard or read mostly concerns the ongoing support by the Pakistan Inter-Service Intelligence, or ISI, for the Afghanistan Taliban, which it helped to create in the aftermath of the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1989, the very same Taliban against whom the U.S., Pakistan's ally and financial supporter, has been waging a counterinsurgency war for almost a decade. That news comes as no surprise to anyone in Washington or to U.S. commanders in the field, but to see it in print has been unsettling, but not apparently to the Pakistan ISI itself, as the New York Times reported on Monday. Well, that's one of the subjects I'll be discussing in about 20 minutes past the hour this morning when I speak with veteran journalist Pratap Chatterjee, who has just written a less publicized article for the online journal Tom Dispatch about U.S. military's capture-kill teams that are operating in Afghanistan and which in other circumstances might be called government death squads. In Afghanistan, they operate officially under the name Task Force 373, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's take a look at some other news which has been distorted or underreported. The forthcoming quote-unquote peace talks between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the man who the United States and its allies consider to be president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, scheduled to begin Wednesday of September 2nd, has been anything but underreported. What one does not read or hear, at least I haven't, is that Abbas's term as president expired in January 2009. That's right, 2009, and he has refused to call new elections. In any other country, were it Venezuela or Bolivia or Iran, Washington would be up in arms. But the Obama administration, like its counterparts in the European Union, are only too willing to maintain the fiction that Abbas legally represents anyone but himself. As for his prime minister, the U.S.-trained economist and Washington and Israeli favorite, Salam Fayyad, he demonstrated his popularity among his fellow Palestinians the one time he ran for election by getting 2%, yes, 2% of the vote. Add to that the apparent fact that Abbas appears not to be even speaking for the Palestine Authority, according to the media line Mideast Daily, which reports that Abbas is now saying he only asked the PA Executive Committee for a one-month grace period to attend the talks and did not authorize a permanent decision. Medialine also said the reports have surfaced that the approval wasn't binding since there wasn't a proper quorum. Only 9 members of the 18-member Palestine Authority Executive Committee, including Abbas, were present for the vote, less than the dozen required for a decision. Many of the top leaders conveniently stayed away from the vote, including Ahmad Karai, a former prime minister, and Hanan Ashrawi. One participant said there wasn't even a vote or show of hands, just opinions expressed. Furthermore, all the executive committee members, including perennial negotiator Saeb Erekat, expressed dismay that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton publicly announced that there were no preconditions for resuming the direct talks, since the Palestinians had asked her as a precondition not to say there were no preconditions. You may recall that Palestine Authority said there'd be no direct talks with Israel unless Netanyahu extended the West Bank settlement freeze past September 26th, a demand that President Obama had made himself before learning the hard way that he is not, quote, the decider when it comes to dealing with Israel. If there was any question about it, State Department spokesperson Philip Crowley ended on Monday when he said that while the U.S. was, quote, mindful unquote, of Palestinian demands for a construction freeze in the West Bank, the issue would only be discussed on September 2nd in Washington. Said Crowley, the issue of settlements, the issue of the moratorium, has been a topic of discussion and will be a topic of discussion when the leaders meet with Secretary Clinton on September 2nd. Palestinian negotiators threaten to walk away from the talks if Israel does not extend the settlement construction moratorium, which would probably suit the Israelis just fine. Arakat, the chief Palestinian negotiator, speaking at a press conference in Ramallah and quoting from a letter Abbas sent to President Obama, said that, quote, if Israel resumes settlement activities in the Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem, we cannot continue negotiations. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu must choose between settlements and peace, Arakat said. We hope that Mr. Netanyahu will choose reconciliation and not further confrontation. If Mr. Netanyahu decides to produce new settlement tenders come September 26, he will have decided to stop the negotiations, end quote. One should not take seriously anything Mr. Arakat or Mr. Abbas is liable to say any more than do their fellow Palestinians, who hold them in contempt for their open collaboration with the Netanyahu regime. Yesterday's Washington Post, for example, carried an article by David Makovsky of the AIPAC-founded Washington Institute for Near East Policy, in which he praised the efforts of the Palestine Authority to do Israel's work in suppressing the Palestinians. Said Makovsky, quote, security cooperation between the PA and Israel has substantially improved. In 2002, 410 Israelis were killed by suicide bombings and other attacks emanating from the West Bank. In the past 3 years, Israel has suffered one fatality from such attack. He did not mention the number of Palestinians who Israel has killed in that period of time. Going on, Makovsky said, speaking in Washington this year, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak said the situation on the ground is, quote, better than any time in the past. Israeli charges that the Palestinians have, quote, a, quote, revolving door approach of releasing terrorists after quick arrests, rampant during the Arafat era, are no longer heard. For its part, said Makovsky, the Palestine Authority no longer attempts to hide its daily security cooperation with Israel. In recent months, the PA even hosted Israeli senior security officials in Jenin, Tul Karim, and Jericho. During the Gaza conflict of 2008-2009, the PA kept the West Bank calm. Because of the improved security, Israel has reduced the number of major manned checkpoints in the West Bank from 42 in 2008 to 14. End quote. That's just the major checkpoints, of course, he's speaking of. There are many smaller ones. What occurs to me after reading Makovsky's observations and recalling the actions of the Palestine Authority under Abbas, his initial support for Israel's onslaught on Gaza, his efforts to suppress the UN investigation of the Goldstone Report criticizing Israel for that onslaught, his acquiescence to Israel's continued siege of Gaza, and his silence in the face of Israeli attacks on Palestinians and home demolitions in the West Bank, is that the upcoming quote-unquote peace talks are another example of Israel-Abbas collaboration and the goal, and therefore of both, is that the talks fail. Far-fetched? Perhaps. But as Akiva Eldar wrote in Monday's Haaretz, quote, it's time to jump into the fountain Rabin Square in Tel Aviv and cheer. The Palestinians have been shafted. One story that you probably haven't heard or read because it calls into question the notion that the U.S. and Israel enjoy quote-unquote shared values. On July 26th, Israel razed the Bedouin village of Al-Aqib to the ground inside Israel, not in the West Bank. 1,500 soldiers were present to bulldoze 45 homes, leaving 300 villagers homeless and destitute. These Bedouins are among the almost 9,000 people that live in villages which are unrecognized by Israel and who have been refused access to services, including water and electricity, since the establishment of the Jewish state 62 years ago. The destruction of the Bedouins' crops and homes is part of an attempt to clear the area for another U.S. tax-deductible Jewish National Fund forest and ultimately to make room for Jewish settlers. This is the third time the village has been destroyed in as many weeks. Twice the villagers have begun rebuilding, and twice the army has come back to demolish or unfinished construction. Moving on to Iraq, President Obama, we are told, has lived up to withdrawing U.S. combat troops from that much-bombarded country, and that he even did so before the deadline he had previously set. As with his promises of change, only those still imbibing his Kool-Aid are taking him seriously. Not only is he leaving 50,000 combat troops in place, disguised under other names, he also seems to be walking away from U.S. responsibilities that he may have inherited from George W. Bush, but are nevertheless now his responsibility as president. These include the invasion-created presence of al-Qaeda in Iraq, who this morning carried out several simultaneously bloody bombing attacks. The millions of Iraqi refugees are still afraid to return to the country. The fact that Iraq's basic services, such as electricity, are less than those provided by Saddam Hussein, even under the sanctions, and a country whose cities and towns remain severely contaminated by the widespread use by British and U.S. forces of weapons whose warheads contain what is euphemistically referred to as depleted uranium. A month ago, U.K. Defense Secretary Liam Fox acknowledged that American and British forces had used depleted uranium, called DU, ammunitions, during the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Said Fox, U.K. forces used about 1.9 metric tons of depleted uranium ammunition in the Iraq War in 2003. And he said that in a written reply to the House of Commons on July 23rd, after a joint study by the Environment, Health, and Science Ministries in Iraq, said that there were communities near the cities of Najaf, Basra, and Fallujah with increased rates of childhood cancers and birth defects over the past 5 years. There are more than 40 such sites across Iraq contaminated with high levels of radiation as well as dioxins. Unlike the United States, which has been guilty of far greater crimes in Iraq, including launching the war, the British Parliament has been holding hearings to determine how Britain was pulled into that war and who were the responsible parties, something our joke of a Congress has not even considered doing. Rather, we are told, solving the problems of Iraq is now the responsibility of the Iraqis. And thus far, no American official has acknowledged that the U.S. fired shells tipped with depleted uranium to kill their countrymen and women, and so simply because they provide better penetration than untipped shells. The shame and blame for that is now Obama's and all those members of Congress who have kept their mouths shut, hoping to put the war behind them. The question for us is, will we allow them to do it? In the midst of the extraordinary tragedy taking place in Pakistan, a story that was briefly mentioned on yesterday's Democracy Now! Merits more attention and calls into question the morality of both the U.S. and its Pakistani clients. In a statement last Saturday, the Asian Human Rights Commission noted that the U.S. Air Force has been denying relief agencies use of the Shahbaz Air Base in Pakistan for the distribution of aid and resistance and assistance. Now, soldiers of the Pakistan Army, a federal minister, and the administration of Sindh Province are now being blamed for diverting floodwaters that threatened to engulf the Shahbaz Air Base during the night between August 13th and 14th, resulting in the floodwaters inundating hundreds of homes and helping to displace 800,000 people. It was reported that the federal minister of sports, along with members of the Pakistani army and a contingent of local government officials, breached the Jamali bypass in Jafarabad, district of Balochistan province, to prevent the water from entering the airbase, which has remained in U.S. Air Force hands since it was handed over to Washington by Pervez Musharraf, then Pakistan's ruler, when the so-called War on Terror was launched in 2001. As a result, according to the report of the Asian Human Rights Commission, the town of Dera Aliyar was drowned. In the meantime, it noted, Pakistan's Secretary of Health has revealed that health relief operations are not possible in the flood-affected areas of Jacobabad and surrounding districts because the Shahbaz Air Base is under the control of the U.S. Air Force, and there are no other airstrips anywhere near that flooded area. Pratap Chatterjee is a freelance journalist, a senior editor at CorpWatch, and a regular contributor to the online news journal Tom Dispatch, where I found his article on U.S. assassination squads in Afghanistan. He has worked extensively in the Middle East and Central Asia, making 9 trips to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. He has written 2 books about the War on Terror, Iraq Incorporated, published by 7 Stories Press in 2004, and Halliburton's Army, published by Nation Books in 2009. Welcome, Pratap Chatterjee, to Takes on the World.
Thanks for having me.
In the face of, well, happy to have you here, yes. In the face of the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan becoming increasingly unpopular here at home, General Petraeus recently launched a media blitz to explain the current goals of U.S. military, and we assume the Obama administration, in that war. On Meet the Press, in terminology reminiscent of our war in Vietnam, Petraeus told host David Gregory, quote, "At the end of the day, it's not about their embrace of us. It's not about us winning hearts and minds. It's about the Afghan government winning hearts and minds," end quote. Then he went on to say that turning Afghanistan into Switzerland was not a U.S. objective, that, quote, "Afghan good enough is good enough," end quote. Given the ample evidence that the Afghan government is a long way from achieving that goal, is this Petraeus' way of conceding the eventual failure of the U.S. mission there, or do you see something else in play?
Well, I think the eventual failure of the U.S. mission, or at least the eventual failure of the Afghan government, seems to be very much a possibility right now. The country is at its most violent in the last since the fall of the Taliban 9 years ago. So now more Americans die there, more Afghans die. There are more violent incidents than any year in the previous 9 years. So by that criteria, it is worse off. The Taliban have been able to strike with impunity in places like Kunduz in the north, and of course they control places like Helmand and Kandahar and the eastern provinces. So it's hardly a success for the Afghan government. One of the key things that the U.S. is counting on is standing up Afghan forces, but this weekend, for example, the leaders of the U.S. sort of force in Afghanistan have said they will need to recruit another 141,000 police and soldiers over the next year in order to keep the country stable and to be able to hand it over. Well, that's actually more people, or as many people as there are in the Afghan army today. And why is that? I mean, the simple reason is the rate of desertion is very high. I mean, so they can cite all the progress they want and how many people are trained and police or soldiers. But the fact of the matter is that these people are quitting and going off to do other things, stay at home, or even worse, join the other side. The battle, by their criteria, has been lost. Now, there are other ways of assessing it. Afghanistan, for example, has never had a local police force. It's been a very skeletal police presence in the country with more focus on guarding government institutions. So the idea of bringing to a largely illiterate population the idea of modern Western policing is perhaps not the best way to approach matters. I mean, this is a country that has relied on village councils to keep law and order. So now you're switching to a different system. You're hoping to teach people a method that works maybe in rural America and Kansas or Tennessee. Well, by that criteria, it's never going to succeed, you know, especially when you're relying so heavily on...
Pratap, we're getting a little static here. I want to call you back in a moment here because on another line here. We're back with Pratap Chatterjee. Sorry for the interruption, bad line. You were talking about the problems of the Afghan army's desertion, some joining the Taliban, and the need for the U.S. calling for actually doubling the size of the present Afghan army. Perhaps you continue.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that the first perennial problem that the U.S. is struggling with in trying to build this force up is the lack of literacy. It's very hard to recruit and train and maintain a westernized police force in Afghanistan when a minimum of 70%, that's the official figure, do not read or write. But the second problem is the whole concept of using westernized police force in a country which has never seen this kind of policing before. It's depended on local village councils and that sort of thing. So the problem really is that people join these police forces, they become targets, and they quit, despite the fact that, I mean, at first the money was really bad, but the money has actually increased to a fairly decent level. It's almost $200 a month. That's a fair amount of money in Afghanistan. But people are still quitting. So this is the most violent time Afghanistan has had in the last 9 years. And the people who are supposed to stop this and take the country forward, the Afghan police and army, are simply not able to take on the job the way the Americans want them to.
Well, it's certainly not that Afghans cannot fight, because we see the Taliban, and before the Taliban we saw the Afghan fighting the Russians, the Mujahideen. It just doesn't seem that there's any kind of motivation that the people who are joining or working in the Taliban, for whatever reasons, are much more motivated than those supporting the government and in the U.S. military. And also, it seems that you have real conflicts that emerge between the Afghan soldiers and U.S. and NATO troops, which lead to what they call rogue soldiers attacking a NATO or U.S. soldier, which we had an example of this morning with Spanish soldiers, two Spanish soldiers being killed by their Afghan driver, and he in turn being killed, and then the public having a rally there protesting the treatment of the dead Afghan soldier who was just left in the road.
Right, well, I mean, that's the third incident, I think, in the last 2 months where Afghan security forces have turned on their handlers and shot and or killed them. So, I mean, here's the thing, is it doesn't take a lot to discourage somebody who's joined the police or the army. You join the police or the army, and then somebody leaves what's called a night letter on your doorstep and says, "We will come for you," and you quit. You know, you know that the Taliban are coming out of, you know, the local community, and you know they're going to be there for decades hence. You know that your family's at risk. Why would you stay? You know, you may join, but then once you've joined and even though you've received the money, you realize that the money's not as worth as much as your life, so you quit. So it's a failing occupation when it's done by Westerners using Western methods. It cannot succeed in the way they want it to.
Well, obviously the Taliban's intelligence is better than that of the Afghan government or the Americans there.
Absolutely. I mean, that's not that surprising. Any rural community anywhere in the world, particularly in places in less developed countries, the network of families and informants, you know, it stretches back generations. So you cannot come in, you know, with, it doesn't matter how many drones you have or how sophisticated your spy network is, you cannot in any way compete with a local decade-long communication system where people know who everybody is and where everybody goes.
Well, it certainly seems that they have got the upper hand, and now there's excuses being made by the certain American officials, generals, that since the Taliban knows that the U.S. is going to leave a certain particular time, you're just hanging back. But that the fact that the U.S. doesn't leave, let's say when President Obama said they're going to start to leave or to begin to leave next year, that they would be dispirited. But it doesn't seem like that's the Taliban story at all.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm no expert in the Taliban at all. I mean, my focus has really been much more on contractors, companies like Halliburton and Blackwater and that sort of thing. And, you know, now I've been studying the WikiLeaks project, but I can't really speak with any authority as to what the Taliban think or do not think. I just don't know. I mean, I've been there many times, but that doesn't mean I know what the Taliban think.
Well, you've just written an article getting to the subject today of Tom's Dispatch about a U.S. unit, Strike Force 373, which has a reputation or goal of becoming manhunting operations, and their teams are called capture kill teams. Perhaps you could tell us about those.
Sure. The manhunting concept is a little misleading. In the article, the focus of the article, Tom labeled it Manhunters, Inc., which is slightly misleading. Basically, the concept of capture kill has existed in the U.S. military for a long time, but it's been refined in recent years, particularly by the Joint Special Forces in Tampa, Florida, you know, Fort Bragg and Norfolk, Virginia, where basically they've been creating teams to go and catch, you know, people on a list for interrogation, and if need be, killing them before they do alleged damage to the U.S. or their Afghan partners. Now, there are quite a number of these teams and quite a variety of them. I mean, even the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency has teams that are supposed to catch drug smugglers and kill them if necessary. Then you have the high-level teams like Task Force 121. These have the CIA and Delta Force, and their job is to track down people like Osama bin Laden or Mullah Omar. And then you have another group, Task Force 1373, and that's sort of the focus of my article. This is the more common garden variety, you might say, capture-kill teams, and they too are joint special forces, so they might involve Green Berets and Navy SEALs and Army Rangers. And they work with the CIA, with information from the CIA, and their job is to go catch people who are leaders of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whatever, and try and bring them back to Bagram for interrogation. If they fail, or if there's any problem, they have authorization to kill. Every time you hear about a night raid, you read just yesterday of a raid that took place that was protested by the Afghans. And that actually took place in place called Surkhurd, which is in Nangarhar province in eastern Afghanistan near the border of Pakistan. So in the middle of the night, there's a story actually in yesterday's Washington Post, where they talk about how the district police chief, Abdul Ghaffar, woke up and he heard that there was gunfire and he sent a police truck out there. He said the Taliban had attacked, but it turned out it was the U.S. Special Operations Forces and their Afghan colleagues. So these guys operate at night. They have their own Task Force 373, has its own helicopters. You know, they have these gunships, the AC-130s, I think, is what they're called. And they go after people. They're supposed to go find them, track them down, and if need be, kill them. So this is actually very disruptive. And in particular, in the story, I talk about how you have these provincial reconstruction teams whose job it is to try and reach out to the local people by building them a mosque or a school. So during the day, if somebody's building a mosque, a school, a road, a hospital, and then at night, if somebody comes and kills somebody in your community, it doesn't really matter who the person is, whether or not they're a leader of Al-Qaeda or civilian or an ordinary person. The impact is the same. It sows fear in the community. And this is the problem, is that at the end of the day, there are going to be some people who believe somebody is guilty and some people who don't. And unfortunately, since the U.S. is getting information from people who say these people are guilty, they use that to go and kill people. You are denying people the basic right that in this country you would describe as habeas corpus, but also something that is common in Afghanistan. The idea that somebody who's accused of something would go before, a shura, a village council, to defend themselves. And that system of justice, has been dispensed with. So you're actually setting back not just Reconstruction, but the whole confidence in the Afghan government and the U.S. military. So these special forces, however, all of this is secret, and we just read of occasional things and people complain. But because of WikiLeaks, we've been able to get hold of a treasure trove of documents that shows from the soldiers' own eyes, and of course this doesn't necessarily mean the most accurate descriptions, but close to as detailed a description as one could get of what this task force has been doing on a daily basis from 2004 to 2009. And, you know, it's not a pretty picture. Many civilians are killed by the soldiers' own admission, where they talk about going in and in one particular case, you know, killing seven children, destroying a school, and not finding one single member of the army, of the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda.
And they say that you kill one civilian and you create 20 new fighters.
Absolutely. I mean, there's certainly that problem. And again, I really want to reiterate, it doesn't really matter if that person is Osama bin Laden himself. You kill somebody, you either make them a martyr in the eyes of people who agree with him, or you, at the very least, you create dissatisfied relatives. What mother is going to believe their son, you know, is a terrorist? So if you haven't at least given them the opportunity to defend themselves in a court, you know, you're going to have some very angry parents, children, relatives, you know, and these are large families in Afghanistan, many angry people. We're not talking about lone, there are no such things as lone wolves, you know, living out there in the middle of Afghanistan, just as they might do in, let's say, an urban setting in the United States. These are very much family units. You go in and you attack a house and you threaten a lot of people and you make a lot of people very angry.
Well, also you have the issue of racism. I mean, my only experience seeing U.S. soldiers in the Middle East was in Lebanon in back in the 80s, the U.S. Marines. Behavior toward the Lebanese and what they call the Lebanese towel heads, camel jockeys, and worse. I can imagine the racism is on the part of U.S. soldiers is almost ingrained, and that it's very difficult not speaking the language or knowing more than a few words. That the Afghani public is certainly sensitive to the fact that they are looked down upon by their U.S. occupiers.
Well, in reality, the U.S. has very little soldiers have almost no interaction with the Afghans, except, you know, the reconstruction teams to sit down and drink tea and that sort of thing. They're not in among the population, despite what General Petraeus and his counterinsurgency doctrine may state. They stay on their bases. And once a day, once a week, they'll go out, do a patrol, they'll sit down, drink some tea. In some ways, the onus of the interaction, it really lies on the translators they've hired. And yet therein lies another problem. If you have a translator who doesn't speak either very good English or the local language, you could have a lot of problems in communication. You could also have the possibility, remote one would hope, that if you have a translator from a different part of the country, you may have somebody who might have an intense dislike for the people in that community. That certainly happened in Iraq, where, you know, you had Shia translators going into Sunni neighborhoods and Kurdish translators going into Shia neighborhoods and what have you. So I don't know of overt, direct racism on a daily basis that occurs. I know, obviously, that American soldiers look down on the Afghan people. I don't think there's as much interaction, but you can see the difference in their lifestyles. I mean, forget about the armor that they wear. The American soldiers clearly are well-equipped, well-fed. They have bases with electricity, you know, and that sort of thing. So it is going to sow resentment among the people, if nothing else.
Well, like according to your article, you have one of the interactions is when American officials have to come and and give money, small amounts of money, in payment for dead civilians that the American military has killed.
Indeed, yeah. So they have this system. It is called, what's the term again?
Saltillo.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, if the Americans kill somebody or injure somebody, they are supposed to provide compensation money. They do that, and actually this particular incident is quite interesting that I start the article out with. This is in March of 2007. Basically what happened was the Marines had a new special forces group that was in this province, Nangarhar, the same province that the raid happened yesterday. And the Marines have never had their own special forces. This is a brand new team. They're a little trigger happy. And a suicide bomber hit them. And so they were kind of scared, and they started opening fire on anybody who came. They fired for a couple of hours at anybody who came by and killed actually a number of civilians. So then when the reconstruction people came along, they couldn't sort out who was killed by the suicide bomber and who was killed by the Americans. Under their rules, they're supposed to compensate the people killed by the Americans. But since they couldn't tell who was who, they gave compensation to everybody, you know. It became a very complex situation, as many of these cases are. This is actually, I think, during the day. A lot of times these conflicts, whether your capture kill teams arrive, happen at night. So you don't know who you're encountering. And there's a number of times where they've killed their own people, you know, so-called friendly fire. There was an example of a group of a bomb that was called in and dropped on a group of what they thought were insurgents, but turned out to be Afghan police officers who were accompanying them. So they weren't able to communicate with these guys, and so then they killed them. And this, of course, led to a lot of anger on part of the Afghan officials, who said, "Well, wait a second. How can you come kill the people who are supposed to be working with you?"
This seems to be repeating itself, one kind of blunder and deadly blunder after another by American and to a lesser extent, but including also NATO forces. NATO seems to be just a handmaiden of the U.S. in an operation that was essentially a U.S. operation from the beginning, that which the other countries have gotten nothing but headaches from.
Well, NATO in Afghanistan is not really much of a... there isn't really much difference between NATO and the U.S. There is, the ISAF headquarters, the International Security Force of Afghanistan. Typically NATO is led by an American general. They work, most of the troops that are deployed are American. There's a NATO training mission, in Kabul at Camp Eggers that is run by an American Lieutenant Colonel William Caldwell IV. So when you say NATO and when you say the U.S., there really isn't much of a difference. NATO, as you suggest, NATO just follows the American lead. It's not like they're two different forces. It's one force, and it is predominantly American-led.
Well, I was saying, implying that NATO, because U.S. is part of NATO, was obliged to come in to Afghanistan since the U.S. considered itself to have been attacked. And the war in every country, NATO country, is opposed. And the presence of their troops in these countries is opposed, as far as I know, by the peoples of every country that has troops in Afghanistan.
Well,
including the United States at this point.
There are a lot of people in Afghanistan who support the presence of American troops. That's quite common because they see them as, and indeed in Iraq, a lot of people believe the Americans, protect them from violent conflict. Whether or not that's exactly true is a different matter, but there's certainly a lot of people, I would say a good chunk of the population, that doesn't want the troops to leave. And that was true in Iraq, too. So I would not go so far to say the majority of the population is opposed to...
Well, I was speaking of the population of the countries that have troops in NATO, not the Afghani population.
Oh, I see.
Well, oh, no, obviously, the Taliban attitude toward women and education and a number of values that many people in the world outside the United States hold dear, the Taliban is very much against. It's a retrograde reactionary movement without...
Just to explain a little bit more about the Taliban, people always use the term Taliban. They talk about Al-Qaeda, they talk about the Haqqani network, they talk about Hikmatyar, all these different groups, and they say, well, this is a reactionary retrograde movement. Well, and you will see the right wing saying, well, that's just Islam and that sort of thing. Just to put it in context, Afghanistan is quite a poor country with a history which is quite feudal. And a lot of the practices that are ascribed to the Taliban are, in fact, feudal practices that were practiced before the existence of the Taliban. And actually, I'm not supporting these things. I'm completely opposed to them. But I think to assume that it's just the Taliban or just Al-Qaeda that supports this, I think is erroneous. This is, in fact, the nature of feudal life in a lot of impoverished Afghanistan. And if you want to change things, it's not about killing the Taliban. It's about education and empowerment and actually teaching the men as opposed to trying to simply empower the women. I mean, you have a centuries-old tradition that the men have maintained, and now it's being seen as wrong, and rightly so. I mean, it should be changed. But I don't think by selecting certain people and saying you're Taliban and you're the leader of the terrorist movement and therefore we're going to kill you, that you're going to erase centuries of what, quite frankly, are bad traditions. You actually have to change the traditions, not kill the people or get rid of quote-unquote a movement. It's not a movement. It's a tradition.
No, I understand what I really don't know about, because it depends on people's perspectives. Before the U.S.-inspired revolt of the Mujahideen against the quasi-socialist government back in 1979, which seemed to have been a positive, brought many positive changes to the Afghan culture, but to the extent that that was accepted through out the countryside, I'm not aware of.
Well, I don't think it was. I mean, the Soviets only controlled so much of the country, and people often talk about the Golden Age in the early 70s of how Kabul was free and there was, you know, women wore miniskirts and people drank and there was music and that sort of thing. Well, that's sort of an urban phenomenon of a wealthy community. I'm talking about a history that goes back centuries.
Yes.
In Afghanistan. Now, this is one place in which perhaps the Soviets, certainly the Americans, have made the situation worse. As the troops go to places like Helmand and Kandahar and take over these rural communities, it actually has a net negative impact on the rights of women. Is it the men take up arms, the men fear for the westernized values that are going to come in from America because they've seen Hollywood movies? So they tend to actually oppress their women more. Now, I will say that post-2001, many girls' schools have been opened. The situation in central Afghanistan, places like Bamiyan, has definitely improved for women. Bamiyan has a woman governor. In the north, in places like Mazar, you know, a lot more women have entered into public life and are going to school and college and that sort of thing. But in a lot of more rural places, particularly in the Pashtun South, the life of women has actually gotten worse under American occupation, precisely because of the presence of the Americans. Now, a system by which literacy was introduced, education, you know, without force and without, you know, men with guns, might have actually changed the sort of decades-old feudal approach, which frankly existed in many countries, not just in Afghanistan. I mean, a lot of the practices that you see today in Afghanistan certainly exist in Pakistan, have existed in India, have even existed in Europe and places like that. It only takes, you know, years of political change as opposed to a hot war to change this. And, I mean, this is what's lacking. The Soviets didn't bring that. The Soviets didn't change anything. And certainly the Americans haven't either.
Well, that's an interesting and a very informative perspective on that, because what we get here, of course, and even I'm susceptible to, is a vision of a particular group of people. I mean, I know that people have joined the Taliban, as Palestinians join Hamas, simply because it is a resistance to an occupying force. And not necessarily do people join forces because they subscribe to all its tenets, but because it's the most accessible means of fighting back against an occupying power. After the occupying powers leave, we see then all kinds of divisions open up between those who have, let's say, made the revolution or overthrown the occupiers. So that's the case.
I would agree, yeah.
Yeah. there is so much to talk about. Briefly, my guest is Pratap Chatterjee. Before we run to the end of the hour, just a question. In the WikiLeaks, there was a lot of information, apparently somewhat supplied by the Afghan intelligence operations, trying to emphasize links between the Pakistani Inter-Service Agency, intelligence agency, and the Taliban, which the ISI, Pakistan ISI, was involved in its formation initially. And even in the New York Times, there seems to be an article that shows that the Pakistan still has very close connections, or enough with the Afghan Taliban to kind of keep their interest, who they seem to represent the Pakistan's interest in Afghanistan. It's very complicated. Perhaps you could explain in a couple of minutes how you're...
Absolutely. I mean, here's the thing, is that Pakistan has long had the intelligence service, the ISI, has long had a relationship with the Taliban, and it's been a very friendly one. And in fact, this may be one of the biggest problems that the U.S. faces in Afghanistan, is the role of Pakistan. Now, that goes without saying, and there was a very interesting article by Dexter Filkins, I think, a couple of days ago, perhaps on Monday, right. In which he basically said that after interviews with a number of senior people in Pakistan, he discovered that the reason that one of the senior leaders of the Pakistani Taliban had been turned over to the Americans was not because the Pakistanis want to cooperate more with America, but because they were afraid that the Taliban were about to betray them and go over to working with Hamid Karzai and potentially, you know, lose them their ability to influence the debate in Afghanistan. They very much want to control it, and they see it as a battle with India, which is also seeking to increase its influence there. And, you know, quite frankly, has been quite a lot more successful. They provided electricity, they built schools. The Pakistanis are afraid of this, and the Pakistanis have definitely had a big role. Now, WikiLeaks, just to jump to a completely different subject before I bring them together, yeah, is a treasure trove for those of us that are journalists or activists or historians, because it shows you what American soldiers have seen and observed in the field and what they have heard. Now, it's very important to understand that that's not necessarily what is true. You're hearing one soldier's account. You're not hearing the other side, the Afghan side. And you're also only looking at secret documents. You're not looking at top secret documents. You're not looking at everything. You're simply looking at incident reports. So what the New York Times divined from these documents was that this was proof that the Pakistanis were helping the Taliban. Now, that may be true, but you can't deduce that automatically from account of American soldiers in the field who, as we've discussed, don't speak the language and have no real context. They're simply repeating what they've heard. So even if it might be true, a lot of the stuff they see, there was a, when WikiLeaks, the big WikiLeaks document was released, the New York Times wrote an article saying, this proves the American soldiers have reported that the Pakistanis are working with the Americans. Well, a lot of that information was actually relatively inaccurate. And The Guardian did a really good piece at the time saying, by the way, look at some of the information they're saying. They're saying that the Pakistanis are planning to buy beer in Miranshan, Waziristan, poison it, and give it to the NATO troops. Well, first of all, you can't buy large quantities of beer in Waziristan in the heart of Taliban territory. Second of all, I don't know how you're going to deliver them to NATO troops. So information they've given is somewhat suspect.
Brought up on that note, and we could continue this for quite some time, but we've come to the end of the hour. I want to thank you very much. Sorry about those phone problems, because I recommend this article in Tom's Dispatch by Pratap. Just go to Tom's Dispatch, I guess, and you could find that article, which deals with issues in Pakistan and Strike Force 373. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jeff.
Take care. Bye-bye.